Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa with the News Gazette. Today, March the 5th, Wednesday, 2025. Let's start on the front page with there's a large picture and a heading with the title, Marching On With a Smile. The fun begins, Illini at Women's Big Town Tournament. And there's a picture of a smiling Illinois standout, Adalia McKenzie, after completing media interviews at the Ubin Basketball Complex on Tuesday. The Illini are headed to the Indianapolis for the Big Ten Women's Basketball Tournament, which starts today. The Illini open at 5:30 p.m. on Thursday. Also on the front page, an article, an opinion article on the front page by Jim Dye, with the heading, Whitman Tackles College Athletics on the Hill. He didn't look a thing like Jimmy Stewart in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, but sporting an orange and blue tie and looking fit and trim, University of Illinois Athletic Director Josh Whitman was the star witness at a U.S. House subcommittee hearing Tuesday, considering federal legislation that would regulate college sports. A lawyer by training and rigidly disciplined by nature, Whitman urged Congress to address issues establishing a level playing field for competing sports programs while at the same time properly compensating athletes in a free market once considered unthinkable. We're trying to create national competition in the absence of a national framework, Whitman said. The hearing itself was something of an oddity on Capitol Hill. No signs of partisan acrimony, but plenty of personal comments from legislators still true to the college sports program. I played on the Caltech football team when there was a Caltech football team, said U.S. Representative Cal Obernolte, a California Republican with a background in video technology. Another legislator, Tennessee Republican Diana Harshbarger, expressed concern that low-profile offensive linemen benefit from name, image, likeness revenues just like glamorous quarterbacks. I love the offensive line, just FYI, she said. Most exchanges were more serious in nature, ranging from compensation for female athletes to determining an athlete's fair market value. In his testimony, Whitman said college sports has undergone dramatic changes in recent years involving compensation and market freedom for athletes, creating the need for a national set of rules. He urged Congress to pass legislation that codifies benefits and protections for university athletes contained in a recent out-of-court settlement, establishes a name, image, likeness, national revenue sharing framework, preempt state laws that have been weaponized to give local schools competitive advantages, establishes limited safe harbor legal protections to fend off antitrust lawsuits, establishes a separate relationship between university and athlete that is not that of employer and employee. Not all the questioning was friendly. U.S. Representative Lori Trahan, a Massachusetts Democrat, complained that female athletes have been shortchanged in the past and are being mistreated financially under the settlement terms outlined in House versus NCAA. She urged women to be compensated equally as required by federal Title IX legislation. Whitman said the dilemma is that income from revenue-generating sports, football and men's basketball, finances the other men's and women's sports that operate at a loss. To fund athletes equally based on gender, he said, would be diverting money away from the athletes who generate that revenue. Whitman warned that federal legislation is not a panacea, that problems will crop up in the new world of college athletics. Indeed, he said, the biggest changes are yet to come. But he contended that without congressional legislation, the problems will be exacerbated because of competing, conflicting sets of rules passed by state legislatures. In an exchange involving antitrust with U.S. Representative Laura Lee, a Florida Republican, Whitman said, "We're not looking for Congress to fix college sports. We're looking for Congress to create a legally defensible space where we can fix college sports." Whitman joined a witness panel that included representatives of women's sports and various institutions. One irony is that Whitman was seated next to South Carolina head football coach Shane Beamer, who coached against Illinois in December's Citrus Bowl. During the bowl game, Beamer became repeatedly agitated by Illinois head coach Brett Bielema and had to be restrained by members of his staff. There was no sign of discord between Beamer and the U of I at the hearing. He and Whitman sat next to each other in compatible non-combat mode. And the last article on the front page has the title, Champaign County Court Urbana Man Gets 45 Years for 2023 Shooting, by Luke Taylor. As he looked at the man who shot him 6 times, Maurice Harris had a question. Was it worth it? What did you get from it? Did any of your kids get anything? Did some family member get anything? Harris asked Antoine Bush, 52, of Urbana, what did you get out of that? Nothing but time in prison. Harris testified Tuesday at a sentencing hearing for Bush, who was found guilty of attempted murder in a 2024 jury trial. In the trial, Assistant State's Attorney Chris McCallum presented evidence he said demonstrated Bush's desire to shoot Harris because of jealousy about a woman Harris was in a relationship with and Bush had formerly been involved with. Investigators found video of Bush apparently showing off a firearm tucked into his waistband, though he and public defender Janie Miller contend that it was not a real gun. In a recorded call Bush made from jail, he can be heard telling a woman to get rid of a chopper. When police arrived on the shooting scene, he found Harris. He accused Bush, and that testimony remained consistent through the trial. Harris has survived 6 point-blank .45 caliber shots in what Champaign County Judge Matthew Lee called basically an execution-style shooting. McCallum asked for a 60-year sentence, 10 years for each time that Mr. Harris was shot by the defendant, while Miller asked for the minimum 31 years, which she said would amount to a life sentence at Bush's age. Lee went between the two with a 45-year sentence. It's a significant sentence, Mr. Bush. It's a significant sentence, Mr. Bush, which is designed to result in the reality that if you can get out of prison, you will, and be a very old man by that time, and that is to protect our community, Lee said. He also said that he wanted to impose a sentence that would make it clear that we cannot tolerate firearms or gun violence in our community. When Harris spoke, he called for Bush to be incarcerated for a long time, but said it wasn't because he hated him. I can't hate you because my God is very powerful, Harris said. I must forgive you wholeheartedly, but your path is your path, and you must now pay for what you've done to me. He claimed that Bush had plotted against him for years and that he didn't deserve to walk freely. Sad to say, you are unfit to be around adults, kids, family members, friends, or foes. No one is safe, Harris said. Bush spoke on his own behalf during the hearing as well, once again claiming that he was not the shooter. I actually feel bad for what happened to Maurice Harris, but it wasn't my doing, he said. I had nothing against this man, and I had no reason to shoot this man. Harris said had to join the hearing via Zoom because he no longer lives in the area. Bush claimed that he'd moved away because the real shooter was still out there. Ultimately, Lee explained that Bush's arguments were irrelevant to his decision in the sentencing because a jury has already made a decision in that matter. I am sentencing you as if you did shoot Mr. Harris, and that's the only thing I can do, Lee said. Just because you said you didn't, that's not in any way evidence of mitigation. Continuing on in our communities, an article about the Lincoln Book Bindery with the title, A New Chapter, Longtime Owner Retires and Sells the Business, by Jana Wiersema. A little over half a century ago, college student Chris Hahn was looking for work to help cover the cost of school when he heard that Lincoln Press Book Bindery might need an extra pair of hands. Just 6 years later, in 1978, Hahn would buy the business from Paul and Shirley Hersey and turn a part-time job into a long-lasting passion. I like craftsmanship, he said. I like putting something together, and I like putting something together well. And it's also turned out to be a wonderful way to meet people. Now, after more than 52 years at the business and 46 years as its owner, Han has decided to retire and sold the bindery business to Dixon Graphics. Lincoln Book Bindery Shop at 1601 North Kohler Avenue closed in late February, and the business service will begin soon in the printing company's location at 105 West John Street in Champaign. Owner Lance Dixon said that he is still working to install the equipment and expects to have the bindery business up and running by March 14th at the latest. Lincoln Book Bindery customers can also expect to see the familiar face of bookbinder Tedra Ashley Wanamuller at the shop. When asked how he knew it was time to retire, Han said that at the age of 73, he is slowing down. "It's bittersweet for sure," he said, "but I don't think it was ever going to be easy, whatever age I did it. But I like the circumstances. I like the fact that I can sell to Lance Dixon, and I like the fact that my longtime employees can go on with it and still have a job." Dixon said that his business has been collaborating with Lincoln Book Bindery for over 20 years as their preferred printer. Over the last year, he had been in discussion with Han and Ashley Wanamuller about the bindery's future. "They weren't sure if they wanted to continue the company because it's kind of a declining industry," he said. "It's kind of rare for someone to want to type this type of binding." Dixon explained that Lincoln Book Bindery specializes in sewn case binding, which involves sewing the pages together and then attaching them to the book cover. While wraparound or glued-on covers are more common, Dixon said that sewn case binding is much more durable. He estimated that only a handful of companies across the nation still practice this craft. "As someone who values this kind of craftsmanship, he didn't want to see the bindery go away completely, so he suggested folding it into his own business. The big thing is keeping it in this community," he said. "I really wanted to keep this type of binding service alive, and it's one of the things that makes Champaign-Urbana unique. I wanted to keep it that way." Urbana Alderman Cherise Hersey said the bindery has been a part of Urbana for over 60 years. "The owner of Lincoln Bindery, Chris Han, bought it from my parents when I was in high school," she said at Monday's committee of the whole meeting. "And before that, there was this very small little piece of a business that was owned by a man named Donald Alexander, who sold it to my dad. But book binderies and binding books is an art." And there's a picture there of the book binding shop with Mr. Han in the background. Another article under our communities from Muhammad Seymour, Illinois High School Association. Muhammad Seymour student named to All-State Academic Team. Two from SJO and Centennial receive honorable mention by Jana Wiersema. Three area student athletes have been honored for their extracurricular involvement, academic achievement, and character. Travis Hoffman of Muhammad Seymour High School is one of 26 students named to the Illinois High School Association's 2024-25 All-State Academic Team. Additionally, Savannah Franzen of St. Joe and Tyler Luchinski of Centennial received honorable mentions. IHSA Assistant Executive Director Stacy Lambert said that the All-State Academic Team represents the best that Illinois has to offer. "When you look at the credentials of these team members, you are not only going to see outstanding grades and incredible test scores, but participation in multiple sports and activities, as well as significant contributions to their school and community," she said. "The ability to not only balance, but also simultaneously excel in these endeavors is inspiring. We are proud to have these future leaders represent the IHSA and Illinois." Every IHSA member school was invited to nominate one female student and one male student for the honor. Requirements included a minimum of a 3.5 GPA after their seventh semester participation in at least two IHSA-sponsored sports or activities during each of the last 2 years of school, and outstanding citizenship. Honorees will be recognized at a banquet in Bloomington on April 13th, IHSA officials said. On A6, continuing in our communities, an article from Parkland College in Champaign by Luke Taylor with the heading Small Exterior Fire Forces Evacuation of Tech Center. A fume extractor for a Parkland College welding lab began releasing smoke Tuesday afternoon, setting off alarms that led students, staff, and faculty to evacuate the campus Applied Technology Center. The Champaign Fire Department found a fire in the fume extractor on the outside of the building and extinguished it using less than 1,500 gallons of water. The department is continuing to investigate the fire's cause. No injuries were reported, and Parkland spokesperson Stephanie Stewart said the college is grateful for the working alarm system and the fire department's quick response. Stewart said the plan was to resume classes in the building Tuesday night, with the exception of anything scheduled in the welding lab, and assess when it's appropriate for the lab to reopen. Our goal is to get them back into the lab as quickly and safely as possible, Stewart said. And there's a picture here of the Champaign Fire Department personnel investigating a fire with on the outside of this fume extractor and dust collector in Parkland College's building, which is called T, apparently the Technology Center. Let's continue on with the opinion piece by J. Mark Powell in his Holy Cow History. There is a picture of President Lyndon B. Johnson delivering his first primetime State of the Union address on January 4th of 1965. The heading is How the State of the Union Became Primetime. The eyes of the nation were glued to the U.S. House chamber once more Tuesday night for America's annual spectacle, the State of the Union address. Though in years there's been a presidential transition, it's referred to as a joint address to Congress, as the new administration hasn't been on the job long enough to have much to report. It's a moment of high drama, a democratic version of European pomp and ceremony. Congress, some of the Supreme Court, and most of the cabinet are all assembled in one room. The House Sergeant at Arms calls out, "Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States." There's an explosion of applause so powerful it nearly registers on radar. And just like the other big TV rating events, the State of the Union address generally draws a lot of eyeballs during TV's choicest viewing time slot, too. In fact, that nationally televised address is among the biggest perks of the presidency. For one magical night yearly, a stuffy speech transforms into a must-see TV event. It wasn't always that way. The relatively few Americans who owned televisions in 1947 were glued to them at 1 p.m. on Monday, January 6th, as they knew that they were witnessing a first. In a grainy black-and-white transmission that looked like it was beamed from Mars, a short man with thick glasses walked up to a rostrum, shook hands, and then turned to the camera. Americans were thrilled. This was the first time they could watch a State of the Union address as it was being delivered. True, they had followed it on the radio for more than 20 years. As this new medium was quickly proving, folks would rather see and hear than just listen to a broadcast. They watched in rapt attention as President Harry Truman delivered a long address right before their very eyes. There was another first that year. 1947 was also the first time the speech was officially called the State of Union Address. Franklin Roosevelt began calling it by that name that we now know starting in 1935. Before that, it was simply called the President's Annual Message. Truman's big talk was a big hit. And so, for the next two decades, soap operas and game shows were interrupted one afternoon every January for the State of the Union. Then Lyndon Johnson changed things again. LBJ was a big man, and, not surprising for a politician hailing from Texas, where everything is bigger, he liked doing things in a big way. Puny daytime TV viewership, when most Americans were working, wasn't good enough for him. Johnson wanted a big audience. That meant prime time. Starting in 1965, the address was moved to the evening. That then led to the televised response to the opposing party. In fact, future President Gerald Ford helped give the GOP's first ever State of the Union response. Now, on a programming equal footing with the likes of All in the Family, Bonanza, and Laugh-In, the event kept evolving. More people watching at home meant more applause with a louder volume inside the Capitol. By the early 1980s, Republicans were putting their hands together for President Ronald Reagan with such precision that Democratic Representative Dennis Eckert wondered what was going on. He peeked at the advance copy of the speech that had been given to his Republican colleagues. Its specified lines where GOP members were encouraged to applaud. Outraged Democrats, from Speaker Tip O'Neill on down, stayed silent throughout much of the following year's address in protest, giving little more than golf claps. Team Reagan also began the tradition of inviting everyday Americans to attend the speech, starting in 1982. A man named Lenny Skutnik was hailed for having jumped into the icy Potomac River a few weeks earlier to save a woman after an Air Florida plane crash. It proved such a hit that presidents have been doing it ever since. This address keeps up with the latest technology, too. It was first streamed live on the Internet in 1997. The first high-definition broadcast came in 2004. For millions of Americans, watching the State of the Union address is much a wintertime tradition as watching the Super Bowl, though the speech's audience is significantly smaller. Makes you wonder, in a future administration, if they will add a halftime show one day to gin up the ratings. Moving on to a review by Katayun Solmazi, A Universal Story, Twin City Theater leaves a profound exploration of family grief and search for belief. Lucy Caldwell's Leaves is a compelling exploration of a family grappling with the aftermath of a suicide attempt. The Twin City Theater Company's production, directed by Owen Skarbalis at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, delves into its themes of mental health, grief, and the often unspoken search for belief during a time of crisis. Leaves follows Lori, a young university student who returns home after attempting suicide. Portrayed by Rebecca Storm, Lori struggles to find meaning in life, becomes the center focus of the play. Her parents, David and Phyllis, David Heckman and Sharon Morber, respectively, and younger sisters Clover and Poppy, Ray Leonberger and Jessica Baltierra, must confront emotions and tensions buried below. Each family member is grappling with their own beliefs, in themselves, each other, and the possibility of healing. For Lori, it's a battle to find something worth living for in a world full of uncertainty. Leaves explores a universal need for belief, not necessarily in religious doctrine, but in something that can offer direction and purpose in life. In a world steeped in disbelief, Lori, consumed by hopelessness, searches desperately for something to hold on to, something that might kindle even a flicker of hope. Her rejection of religion, "I don't believe in hell or heaven or even earth," reveals the depth of the void she experiences, a profound emptiness that threatens to swallow her completely. Lori's suicide attempt leaves an emotional weight that lingers in the family. Much like the ripples of stone sinking into water, the person may have sunk, but the consequences of their pain remain. The emotional aftermath distorts relationships, leaving family members grappling with guilt, fear, and confusion. The ripple effect continues to reverberate, complicating their efforts to make sense of the traumatic event. Leaves offers no tidy resolution. Healing is slow and uncertain. The cast delivers exceptional performances, with Storm's portrayal of Lori capturing the depth of a young woman caught between despair and hope for healing. Morber and Heckman's portrayals of Phyllis and David highlight their internal struggles with guilt and helplessness. Clover and Poppy bring emotional complexity, perfectly capturing the breadth of their characters. Leaves premieres on premiered in 2007 at Mick Lally Theatre in Galway, Ireland. Earning praise from both critics and audiences, it later moved to the Royal Court Theatre upstairs in London, where it continued to receive acclaim. Caldwell's sensitive portrayal of family dynamics and mental health earned her a George Devine Award and the Susan Smith Blackburn Award, solidifying her as a rising star in contemporary theatre. Caldwell, who was born in 1981 in Belfast, Northern Ireland, is a celebrated playwright, novelist, and radio dramaticist whose work explores themes of identity, family, and human relationships with exceptional sensitivity. In Leaves, Caldwell's writing is both empathetic and raw, creating an authentic portrayal of family life in the face of mental health struggles. This is not just a play about depression, it's a universal story of the human experience, about love, loss, and long road to healing. Again, this play is at the Independent Media Center and can be seen soon. Being more specific, it's at the Twin City Theater Company, and it's the Twin City Theater Company, and it's presenting Leaves, written by Lucy Caldwell and directed by Owen Skarbalas. When? 7:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday, 2 p.m. on Sunday. Where? Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, 202 South Broadway Avenue in Urbana. Tickets are $18 for adults, $15 for students, and seniors age 65 and older. There's not much more in our communities, and I'm going to wait till the next half of the News Gazette to get into our sports, which is quite a bit with the women's basketball coming up. So I'm going to head over to the beginning and read the history section, area history. In 1925, there was quite a stormy scene and no little excitement during this morning's session of the Champaign County Board of Supervisors when Supervisor John Mellon declared that Paul Lindsay and Robert Ward, convicted murderers not yet taken to the penitentiary because of pending appeals, should be liberated to save the county the expense of feeding them. Then in 1975, the Champaign City Council voted 5-1 to approve an ordinance extending bar closing hours from 1 a.m. to 1:30 a.m., but the law would not go into effect for 10 days. Sale of liquor will continue to be allowed only until 1 a.m., but patrons will not be forced out of bars until a half hour later. The council's action reverses its November 17th decision to close the bars promptly at 1 a.m., a law which met with much opposition from tavern owners and customers. In 2010, the police issued fewer tickets than in previous years, and Champaign Police Sergeant Scott Friedland said unofficial St. Patrick's Day participants were much more cooperative this year. And then there's a picture of, on Wednesdays we'll introduce the students who make up Year 9 of High School Confidential, powered by Danville Area Community College. Today, Blue Ridge's Carson Steiger. Of all she's involved in at school, softball, cheerleading, yearbook, National Honor Society, it's her longtime involvement with Night Buddies that brings great joy to Carson. At Blue Ridge, high schoolers are paired with elementary school students to visit weekly to lend support and offer advice. Play outside, play in the gym, read, color, and more, said Carson, who's done it for 4 years. Seeing how excited your night buddies get when they see you is so comforting, and my favorite part, providing a great role model to the little kids is important. An outstanding student athlete, Carson will attend Millikan to study nursing, but first it's year 13 of organized softball in, of course, uniform number 4. That's the age she started playing and the number she's kept since day one. A resident of Mansfield, my favorite part is knowing many, if not all, my neighbors and other residents in the town. Carson has thrived in her reporting role with the News Gazette. The best part is showing off what our small school has to offer, she said. I've gone to Blue Ridge my whole life, and I think it goes unrecognized for the many things that we have to offer. And that'll be this half of the News Gazette, dated March the 5th, 2025. I will come back for the second half of the News Gazette in just a moment. Thank you.